Well, if you open your Bibles then at Daniel chapter 11, and this morning we'll be reading basically the whole chapter, starting second half of verse 2, but then going all the way through to the end. So it's quite a long chapter, but I think it would benefit us to read it all and then look at it together. So just prior to this, Daniel has received this vision, this angelic figure has visited him and has opened his eyes to see that what he's engaged in is a sort of spiritual war, spiritual battle that is taking place in the heavenly places. Well, let's read this chapter then, starting Verse 2. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. After some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. And from a branch from her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, and for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight with the king of the north. And he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail, for the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. In those times many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Afterwards he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back towards the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant. And he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged, and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear, and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many, and shall divide the land for a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab, and the main part of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and of silver, and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. And he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. And so ends our reading in God's word. Well, there is a huge amount going on here in Daniel chapter 11. And trying to get your head around all of these details can leave you in a bit of a spin, can't it? I'm sure as I was reading the passage there, probably most of you, maybe all of you, were sitting there thinking, what is going on here? all of these details, these kings of the north and the south and all of these battles and who is he and who is this particular person, all of these details, they can leave you in something of a spin. I mean, I've had the luxury this past week of reading this passage several times, and it still leaves my head in something of a spin. It is a very difficult chapter to understand. So let's ask the question, what are we to make of it? How are we to understand Daniel chapter 11? And I think as we answer that question, it's helpful at the outset to remember that this chapter is part of one whole visionary unit. It's part of one whole visionary unit that starts at the beginning of chapter 10 and then runs through all the way to the end of chapter 12, to the end of the book of Daniel. And this is a vision that is given to Daniel, we're told, at the start of chapter 10, which we looked at a couple of weeks ago, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So that's about 536 BC. This is when Daniel is given this vision that runs all the way through to the end of chapter 12. And this vision concerns what is going to happen to God's people in what is called the latter days. Now you can see that in verse 14 of chapter 10, if you glance back there. This angelic figure says to Daniel that he's come to make him understand what is to happen to your people, the people of God, in the latter days. For the vision, he says, is for days yet to come. So it's a vision that is for the people of God. And the bulk of that vision is in chapter 11. And what we have here in chapter 11 is what I've called a history of the latter days that are mentioned in verse 14 of chapter 10. We have here a history of the latter days. History told before it happens. That's one way, I suppose, or one aspect of prophecy. It is history of what is yet to come, at least in its predictive element. And what you need to realize is that it's not a history of what is yet to come that is given simply for the sake of imparting information. As if to say, look at how clever I am, I can tell you what is going to happen in the future. That's not the point. The point is that this is history given for God's people, for their sake, for their good, for their faith, for their life. And it's important to bear that in mind when we come to Daniel chapter 11, which does leave your head in a bit of a spin. And there are so many details here that it's difficult to sometimes fathom what is going on. But do please remember at the outset, before we get into it a little bit, do please remember that this is a history of the latter days, which from Daniel's perspective is yet to happen, that is given for the good of God's people. It's given to help them and to strengthen them, to build up their faith, their hope, and their whole walk with the Lord. So learning these lessons of history is for your good. Please remember that. So with that by way of introduction, what are the lessons of history that we learn here in chapter 11? Now, we have quite a lot to get through, and I'm not sure we're going to get through everything this morning. I've got three lessons, and I'm not sure we're going to get to the end of the third lesson this morning. So this may well carry on to our next time looking at Daniel, the book of Daniel. But let's begin, and let's see how far we get anyway. And we'll at least get to the end of the first point. I'll guarantee you that. And the first point, the first lesson of the history here in Daniel chapter 11 is this, that the plans of the nations will be frustrated. The plans of the nations will be frustrated. They will be foiled. They will fail in the end. All of their plans, all of their schemes, in the end, will come to nothing. That's the big lesson, really, from verse 2 all the way through to verse 20, taking that block as our first lesson. And these verses provide a survey of the history that will unfold, from Daniel's perspective, from the time of Cyrus, so the 6th century BC, 536, all the way through to the early part of the 2nd century, really up until 175 BC. That's the period of history that this chunk of Daniel chapter 11 covers, 536 through to 175 BC. This is not, believe it or not, an exhaustive account. It would be even longer if it was an exhaustive account. It's a selective account. And the history that is selected is, you will see, a perfectly precise prediction of that future history. That's something that you see in Daniel chapter 11. The history that is selected is a perfectly precise prediction of that future history. It does come to pass exactly according to what is laid down here in Daniel chapter 11. And, you know, if nothing else, this should reinforce our confidence in the truth, the authority, the reliability of God's word. That's something that you can take away from Daniel chapter 11. Everything happens, everything transpires according to what is written down here. So that should give you great confidence. So let's get into it then. And we read at the end of verse 2 that three more kings shall arise after Cyrus in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he's become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Who is this fourth king? This king with great riches. This is King Xerxes, or as he was also called, Ahasuerus, and you come across him in the book of Ezra. And then we move from the Persian kingdom to the Greek kingdom, verses 3 and 4. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion. He shall do as he wills. And as soon as he's arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. Who's this a reference to? It's a reference to Alexander the Great, that great military warrior and leader who ruled over the Greek kingdom that he established from 334 to 323 BC. But then when he died, his kingdom didn't stay as one unified kingdom. It eventually split into four separate kingdoms. And then, from verse 5 all the way through to verse 20, the vision focuses upon the two most dominant kingdoms that emerged from the breakup of Alexander's Greek kingdom. That's where the focus is. The two most dominant kingdoms that emerged after Alexander's death and the splintering of his kingdom into four parts. And one of those was the Ptolemaic kingdom, the Ptolemies. Forgive me if the pronunciation isn't correct, but it begins with P, T, and then goes on. The Ptolemies of Egypt. And these are the kings of the south, okay, that we come across here in Daniel 11. The kings of the south are the Ptolemies, the Ptolemaic kings of Egypt. So they're in the south. That's one major kingdom. And then in the north, the kings of the north, they are the Seleucids. Again, forgive me if that's not the way to pronounce that word. The Seleucids, who are based in Syria. So you have the Syrian kings, the Seleucids in the north, and then the Ptolemies, the kings of Egypt in the south. And this period from verse 5 to verse 20 covers the period from 323 BC, the death of Alexander the Great, all the way up to 175 BC. So that's, 150-ish years, I suppose. That's right, yeah, 150 years or so. And these verses, what they do, what they're recording here, is the competition for dominance that these two kingdoms had with each other. These two great rivals, they vied with each other continually over that period of history for dominance in that particular region. That is what is going on here. It's a record of their competition to become the great power in that region. Now, I'm not going to look at every single verse in this section. I'm just going to pick out a few in order to show you what the main point of these verses is. And I'm going to tell you the main point up front before we get into the details. So at least you can remember that. And the details will then hopefully reinforce the main point, or they should do anyway. The main point is this, that kings and nations will plot, and they will scheme, and they will conspire, and they will vie with each other, they will go to war with each other in order to become the great power, in order to become the dominant force. But in the end, all of their furious activity will come to absolutely nothing. Their plans, as I said at the start, their plans will be frustrated. In the end, they will fail. So let's look at how how this vision makes this particular point. Well, we'll start with verse 6. I'll read the verse and then seek to explain it. Verse 6 says, after some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her and he who supported her in those times. What is going on here? Well, this is a reference to Ptolemy the Second, king of Egypt. This is about 250 BC we're at here. Ptolemy the Second deciding to give his daughter Berenice to the king of the Seleucids in the north, who at the time was Antiochus II. So he's trying to make a marriage alliance between the two kingdoms by giving his daughter Berenice to the king of the north, the king of the Seleucids, Antiochus II, on the basis that her son, his grandson, would then be heir to the Seleucid throne. That's his strategy. Give my daughter in marriage to the king on the basis that the son she has becomes the king, and then, my kingdom will become the dominant kingdom. That's his strategy, that's his ploy. It's a clever plan, I suppose, in many ways. But the trouble is, 2 years later, Ptolemy II died. He died, and after that, Antiochus II decided he didn't really much fancy Berenice anymore, and so he divorced her. He actually went back to his first wife, and Berenice and the son that she had ended up being killed. Could go into more details, but that's basically what happened. And so Ptolemy II's plans were frustrated. He thought, I'll become the dominant power through this marriage alliance, but in the end, that doesn't work out. And then several years of war ensue between the two kingdoms, and that's what's recorded in verses 7 and 8. And the Ptolemies in the south, they end up gaining the upper hand. And then we read in verse 9, then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. Now this is a reference to Seleucus II invading Egypt in about 242 BC, trying to gain some power, some dominance, but he's defeated. and he has to return to Syria. And so his plans were frustrated. But the Seleucids, they recover. They grow in power, they gain some strength, and they keep on attacking Egypt. They don't give up. They keep on attacking Egypt. And that's what we see in verse 10. They keep coming, and they overflow and pass through, and they even carry the war as far as his fortress. They are incessant in their efforts to try to gain dominance. And so we read in verse 11, then the king of the south, who at this time is Ptolemy the Fourth, the king of the south, moved with rage because he's being attacked all this time, shall come out and fight with the king of the north, who by this stage is Antiochus the Third, also known as Antiochus the Great. But despite his superior forces, that is the superior forces of Antiochus, he can't overpower the king of Egypt. He's given, as it says in verse 11, he's given into his hand, and so his plans are frustrated. But before too long, verse 12, Ptolemy the Fourth's heart is exalted. He's had this amazing victory over the Seleucids, but he becomes proud, and his plans end up being frustrated. He shall not prevail, we're told. Skip forward to verse 17. There we read, that is Antiochus the Third, still Antiochus the Great at this time, he shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Now, what's going on here? Well, remember earlier on, there was an attempt on the part of Ptolemy in Egypt to give his daughter Berenice in marriage to the Seleucid king in order to gain the dominance in that region. And this is the similar thing going on here, only this time it's the king of the north, Antiochus the Third, giving his daughter, a woman called Cleopatra, not the one that we all know, but another Cleopatra, giving her to the king of Egypt at the time, Ptolemy the Fifth. And he does so in order to try and undermine the latter. So that's what's going on. But guess what happened? You won't believe this, but guess what happened? Cleopatra actually fell in love. She fell madly, deeply in love with the king of Egypt, Ptolemy the Fifth. That didn't happen very often in the ancient world, did it? Most of the time, these marriages between the sort of political elites, they were marriages to try to strengthen the dynasty, to strengthen the kingdom. And often, you read history, the husband and the wife, they didn't like each other very much. There are marriages designed really for political ends. But, amazingly, Cleopatra falls madly, deeply in love with her Egyptian husband, and so ends up siding with him and foiling the plans of her poor father, Antiochus the Third. His plans are frustrated. And we go on and read more. Now I can see, I'm just selecting some details here. There's lots more that could be said, and I'm very happy to talk about it with you in detail afterwards. But I think you get the point. I think you get the picture. There is so much going on here. It's what you could describe as a sort of furious squall of history. It's like storms are raging on the historical scene. This king battles with that king, and that king responds, and they're each vying for dominance, and they think, I'll give my daughter in marriage because that will give me the power and the dominance that I seek. And all the time, their plans are foiled. And you see that repeated disjunctive, but this happened, but that happened. And that's the sort of literary marker to show that all of their plans failed. They are all frustrated. In the midst, you see, of the furious squall of history, what do we read? We read about an inescapable note of futility. And that's what you're meant to see here, an inescapable note of futility. In the midst of all of the stormy activity, battles, wars, marriages, all the rest of it, These plans, these schemes, they just come to nothing. They're all frustrated. One commentator, a guy called Ian Duguid, puts it this way. It's a longish quote, but I'll break it up. I think it's so helpful. He talks about how Daniel 11 provides a profound perspective on history. This is one way, not the only way, this is one way to understand the historical process here in Daniel chapter 11. He says that history is in many ways a continual story of wars and rumors of wars, and yet, though the tide in the affairs of men and of nations comes in and goes out, in the end, it accomplishes precisely nothing. I mean, that's one way to understand the historical process. It's like the sea. The tide comes in and it goes out again, in and out, but it stays in the same place, doesn't it? And nothing really is changed. Nothing really is achieved. And Duguid goes on to say that Daniel 11 shows us the fallen world pursuing the wind and finding it elusive. The fallen world, its kings, its rulers, its nations, its kingdoms, pursues the wind and finds it elusive. It can't grab on. What do politics and power gain for all of their toil under the sun? I mean, we're going through Ecclesiastes in the midweek at the moment, and that's the question that the preacher there in Ecclesiastes asks. What does man gain for all of his toil under the sun? Life just seems so pointless. And in many ways, that message of Ecclesiastes is writ large in the geopolitics of Daniel chapter 11. What do kings and presidents, nations and kingdoms, all of these high and mighty rulers, what do they gain lastingly for all of their toil, their fierce toil under the sun? Now, why are we told this? Why was this message needed for, in the first place, Daniel's fellow Judeans, especially those who went back to the land? Well, I mean, just put yourself in their position and put yourself in the position of these Judeans living through this time. This is the sort of intertestamental period between the end of the old covenant canon and the beginning of the new. Put yourself in their shoes. Where are they? Geographically, they are sandwiched, you see, between the Seleucids to the north and the Ptolemies to the south. And they are subject to their competition for power and control. And they are buffeted about by the ebbs and flows of the historical process. They, by comparison, they're so small, aren't they? So insignificant. There weren't that many that went back. The temple was just so much less glorious than it had been when it was first built. And those glory years of David and Solomon, they've long gone. They are a small, insignificant nation compared to the Seleucids, compared to the Ptolemies and all the others. And they needed to hear, didn't they, that small though they were, buffeted though they were by these great kingdoms, by these furiously active kingdoms, those kingdoms would eventually come to nothing. They would disappear. Their plans would be frustrated. That's what they needed to hear. And of course, you need to hear this too, don't you? Especially for us in Western Europe, where the church is just so small and insignificant compared to those who operate the levers of power in high politics, compared to what it was perhaps in the past. The church is so small and so insignificant, and we are buffeted about by those who are in authority. But you need to know that those kings and those rulers, those presidents, those prime ministers, they will come and they will go. They will rise up, they will fall down. Their plans will come to nothing. You know, one day, some of you might not like to hear this, but one day the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland will disappear. It will disappear. And so too, by the way, will the United States, and so too will China, and so too will Russia, and so too will Germany, and so too will France, and so too will Korea, and so too will Japan, so too will every nation, every king, every ruler. They will all disappear. And what will be left? What will be left? Will anything be left? Well, yes, one kingdom will be left. One kingdom with one king, Jesus Christ. And his church. You see, in the midst of the squall of human history, what's Jesus doing? Jesus is quietly, almost unobtrusively, building his kingdom. And it's a very successful building project. He will not fail. His plans, they will not be frustrated. One day his kingdom shall cover the face of the earth as the waters cover the sea. The plans of kings, great leaders, they come to nothing. They're all frustrated. They all ultimately end in failure. And of course, it must have looked when he was hanging on a Roman cross as if Jesus' plans had been frustrated too. It must have looked that way, mustn't it? As if his plan, his kingdom had all ended in failure. But of course, his death and his resurrection, they are at the very heart of God's eternal plan to bring salvation to a lost world. His death, tragic failure, though it must have looked, was actually the glorious fulfillment of his plan, his eternal plan to save sinners. Where is the Roman Empire now, under the authority of which Jesus was crucified? Where is the Roman Empire now? Where is the Greek Empire now? Where is the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid empires? Where are they now? They've all gone. They've all long gone. They've all bitten the dust of history. Meanwhile, Christ's kingdom slowly, quietly, unobtrusively continues to grow. It's still here. It will always be here. His plans, they are never frustrated. His plans for you, never frustrated. It's a glorious thing to belong to his kingdom. That's lesson number one, and I can see it's now almost 11:45. So you've only got another hour. No, I'll stop there. We'll carry on with the rest. I had a feeling this might happen, but we'll carry on with the rest in a couple of weeks' time, because there's much more to learn. But go away and remember that. All the plans of the nations, they're frustrated, they fail. But God's plans never fail, and his kingdom continues to grow.